The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Well, hello, and welcome to a special Thanksgiving edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you for joining me. If it's the first time, we're here to make you some money, to help you with the markets, to understand what's going on and what's not going on, make some sense out of this craziness that we're finding in these markets these days. And coming up on the show today, on episode 35, we have Kristen Bentz, who is the managing editor for realmoney.com, or thestreet.com as you may know it. And we're going to be talking some discussion about retail stocks, what's going on with that sector. Joining us with that and the panel discussion is going to be Evan Schumann, who is the retail and technology editor for eWeek, a Ziff Davis publication. So we got a jam-packed show. Before we get into that, I thought I'd have a little discussion here with you, kind of cover a couple of things. Of course, thank you so much for joining me today. We're going to talk about maybe some things that are really bubbling through in this really nasty situation. I want to mention that thank you so much for taking the opportunity to buy the book. Many of you took me up, or all of you, on that 100 book that I had mentioned last time, where you can get that special discount. Unfortunately, that discount is over, but do yourself a favor. Do me a favor. You know, the way that we support this show is very simple. It's by people like you helping us out and doing what you can. If you like what you hear, pick up a book. Go to Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. The Disciplined Investor, Central Strategies for Success, is currently on sale in those two retail establishments, or you can go to our site. In addition to that, if you've been waiting, many of you have, and many of you have called me, finally, there's the first official, real hardcore announcement. The audiobook is available at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can go there and download it, as well as all of the charts, graphs, and everything else for $24.95. So do yourself a favor. Pick that up before Thanksgiving, because you know what? We need some help in these markets, all of us, and maybe that a few things will give you some ideas to what to do in that. So pick up the book, and I'd appreciate it. Again, that's how we get things going here and keep it going. Now, let me kind of switch gears for a minute. Let me talk about what's going on in these markets, or really what's not. You know, the only thing worse than running out of turkey on Thanksgiving is talk about cutting dividends on stocks, I think. There is nothing here that is to be taken lightly. It ranks up there with yelling fire in a theater, and it's almost as bad as telling an investor that they can't withdraw money from their accounts. Maybe if you're a hedge fund, a mutual fund, saying, hey, you know what? You can't get your money. The recent flurry of negative news concentrating on the financial sector has many investors really running for cover, as many are very apprehensive about what else can lurk beneath the surface. Of course, that is relatively clear to most of us, isn't it? What may not be so apparent is what financial firms will do in their desperation to help defray the costs associated with their frolic through what we say is Hell's Gate, which is now better known as the mortgage business. It is extremely troubling to find that the shoes dropping are not showing any signs of abating. In fact, it seems that the number of shoes related to the problem in the financial sector can only be matched in quantity to those found in the closets of Imelda Marcos. Remember her? The truth is that the recent announcement by the Federal Home Loan Corporation, also known as Freddie Mac, who is considered a traditional conforming lender, not the subprime type, is much more significant, as the realization that the spread of the subprime problem has apparently seeped into areas that has not been anticipated by most analysts. Now, direct from the pages of Freddie Mac, I took some notes, and it says, as of the September 30th website, they had $3 billion of a cushion, this cushion of $3 billion over the mandatory target surplus that they needed. They said this is a real permanent at-risk capital that provides the first line of defense in an unlikely event of a financial catastrophe at Freddie Mac. Since shareholders are the ones providing the capital, they, and not the taxpayers, will be the ones to bear the losses. Shareholders expect an adequate return on their investment in exchange for putting their money on the line. But like any other investor, they buy our stock at their own risk. Very nice. Now, according to reports by the company, Freddie Mac saw their fair value of its net assets decrease by about $8.1 billion, I believe it was, in the third quarter. They also hinted at the possibility just recently that they'll be cutting the dividend in a defensive move to protect the required level of capital surplus that they're required to have, which is imposed by regulators. A cut to their dividend would immediately help to stem the reduction of assets due to their ailing portfolio, but it's whether or not it will be significant enough is what is really the question. If we look at the 661 million shares outstanding, we look at a 50% cut in their common share dividend, it could save the company about $661 million or so. And this would bring the yield down to the current shareholders, but keep it reasonable enough for new investors. Of course, screwing the investors that are currently with them. Yet that will not offset the ancillary problem of the reluctance by many of their maybe to-be investors to buy their debt, even if the ratings are continually high. The combination of investor mistrust and the problems with corporations misguiding, or at least the perception that corporations are misguiding, along with a poor record of the rating agencies, is not going to bode well for any coming offerings, anything that comes out at all by Freddie Mac. Realize that the markets have this unique way of self-assessing. Even if the rating maintains high, the markets will self-assess and will react accordingly. The fact is that investors will require a tremendous amount more yield for risk involved in this particular position. Now, as the story is unfolding, there's been a lot of news and speculation about how is this company going to replenish some of the assets that they lost and bring in new money to provide for its continuing operations. Because remember something, when this company is lending and buying mortgages and using funds, they have to get it from somewhere. They have to develop these assets. But if we have this credit market crunch, where are they going to get this money? Well, it looks like it's going to be from the issuance of billions of dollars of preferred stock. The problem rests in the fact that while they're usually more liquid than traditional bonds, these preferred stocks have no guarantee that the company will make any repayment of the principal ever in the future. Now, obviously, I'm a big fan of preferred stocks, but I've never bought these Fannie Mae's or Freddie Mac's because I thought there was, the yield wasn't good enough and there were some questions about the underlying assets of the company itself into this mortgage fiasco. But why would anybody look to enter a position if they had all the information at hand that we know now about Freddie Mac? Who's going to jump in to buying preferred stocks at what, a 5.5% yield, what they've been yielding so far? I don't think so. Now, what happened with the analysts? I mean, the people we're supposed to be looking to, the broad base of experts that give us the advice about what to do with our money, what stocks to go to, how they're rated, what their future earnings are. Well, over the past several months, there have been 15 analysts that have covered this stock, and they have seen fit to keep this stock's ratings constant. I mean, it's amazing. According to the published reports by the S&P, the Standard & Poor's, the monthly trend has not changed since August. In other words, since August and before. There were 3 analysts that had a buy rating, 3 that were a buy hold, and 9 that had a hold rating. Now, unless hold is the new code for sell, there is something slightly wrong here. They have it wrong too. Furthermore, these same analysts are estimating a 73% increase in EPS through 2008 as of the last report. Well, suffice it to say that this may be slightly aggressive at this point. Would you agree that the outlook is not bright for a swift recovery for this company? Even if the Fed looks to cut rates or even inject a tremendous amount of liquidity into the system right now, I don't really see how this company is going to be a viable investment or a beneficial investment for anyone. The real issue is what is going to be left of the domestic financial system unless a significant, and a significant is probably something none of us have ever really thought of. Probably even the people running for their offices right now have really never considered how significant this overhaul needs to be, but it needs to be significant, it needs to be sound, and it needs to be immediate. Once again, the weak dollar that we've talked about combined with excessive spending and absolutely outright pathetic oversight on the part of this administration has made our economy more vulnerable than it has been for decades. This is not the same as it was in 1999 through 2002. That was a bad time. No, that was a market event that was predicated on the fact that this massive and unrelenting speculation allowed for markets to overheat. And as the adjustments made by the Fed, you looked at them more as a market event and a market adjustment rather than economically based and economically centric. Currently, there is a cancer eating away at the core of our financial system, and it is clearly rooted in greed. Once again, the derivatives, fancy packaging of financial securities, along with a heavy dose of corporate misguidance, has provided for disastrous results. And who's going to pay for it? Yeah, you. Raise your hand. Yeah, me. Raise my hand. Now all you're going to hear is buy and hold as the only salvation and the only saving commentary after there were so few that were willing to step out and tell us what was really going on. Way back in July, we predicted that this was not only the storm, not only the eye of the storm, this was really something that was going to be very, very significant. And all of a sudden, August, it just turned around and it was like nothing. Now investors are left to lick their wounds and hope that the economy is able to sustain this direct blow. Remember, if we compare technology, the technology sector, and think about this as the brains of the overall body, right? We can say that the financial sector is the heart. The heart that pumps all of the necessary components throughout the system, allowing for it to work. The fact of the matter is that there was many things done by individuals, by speculators, and by regulators who have to share in the blame of what's going on right now. But rest assured, we all need to shore up our positions, watch your credit, watch your accounts, make sure to keep a close eye. And if you can't do it, get someone else to do it for you to help you with it. You know, you shouldn't be saddled with the full responsibility if you have to work, you have a family, or whatever it is. Hire somebody qualified to do so. But in the end, we have to watch out and be really wide-eyed right now at what's going on, because otherwise we can get hurt. The fact of the matter is, I can tell you, on several occasions, we looked at stocks in positions that seemed to be totally broken down to a point that there was no further it can go down. And what happened? They continued to move down for the next several weeks. Now, I will share with you that I do believe that much of this is overblown at this point because the financial system will be fixed. Whether it's this year or next year, it will be fixed. This is not the end of the world right now. It's not happening. According to Harry Dent, it's not going to happen to 2009. John Dvorak, also a good friend of mine, talks about 2009. Talked to him recently about it. Now, am I staking my entire portfolio on that? No. But I will tell you this. It is not time, because we still have a lot of health underlying all of this. We just have to get rid of this cancer. So with that, we'll finish my rant for the day. Hopefully that didn't totally freak you out and give you a pause to just skip Thanksgiving altogether and just flush your head down the toilet. But I will tell you that there is some good things coming as soon as we can get past a lot of this right now. So just kind of hang in there right now. And we're going to be back in a moment. We're going to have a great interview. I'm going to give a call to two great people in the industry, Kristen Bentz and Evan Schumann of the retail area, the retail world. We're going to talk about lots of stuff that's going on right now, and maybe some of the we can dig out some retail that we can invest in, because it's looking kind of bleak out there for retail. Thanks a lot. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
Looking for answers to today's complex financial markets? Then be sure to get your copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, your all-in-one guide to investing.
In 3, 2, 1. And now back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, gang, so it's Thanksgiving. It's time for holiday shopping, that wondrous time of year where we fight the crowds to get into the stores, and we're going to talk about what's hot and what's not in the retail. And joining me today, we've got a great panel. We have Kristen Bentz, who is the managing editor of Real Money for TheStreet.com, and she has a lot to say about this because she is actually the retail expert at TheStreet.com. She also has her own blog, which is called The Talented Blonde. And we also have Evan Schumann, who is in the retail technology area. He's the editor for eWeek, which is a Ziff Davis publication. He also has his own blog, which we'll mention throughout the show, because I think that's something. So thanks for joining me, gang.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start off with this. It seems that retail equals consumer equals retail, and there's been this ongoing battle of what's really going on with the consumer. Consumer confidence has been slipping dramatically, forward-looking and current present situation. Last week, I think that Jim Cramer from your group, Kristen, put the kibosh on retail.
He's Friday. A little short seller in retail these days.
Right, which is a quick turnaround, actually, because I recall that he was pretty confident with retail for a while.
He was. I think you have to pick and choose your spaces where you want to be right now in retail. And, you know, my contention is that not all retail is bad. It just depends. You have to know where people are shopping, where they are spending their money, because they are. They're just not spending it in the way and the fashion in most of the, you know, typical retail outlets that the news media has actually thought of previously.
Right. So let's talk about some of the things in the retail area. We know that, at least we think we know, that electronics is going to be hot. I was in the mall this weekend and we were looking around and the, game stores were just popping. In the mall, they have these Wii stations set up. So what's going to be hot in retail right now, do you think, Evan?
Well, mostly we're not looking at the products being sold per se. That would not be something we would track. We're looking more at what the retailers are going to be doing in terms of bringing in mobile phones for purchases within store, dealing online versus offline, all that integration. And we're seeing a lot of retailers trying to push the envelope on that, including, surprisingly, Walmart, which has never been on the cutting edge of a lot of online efforts. But they're now going to be offering exclusive promotions to cell phone customers. So in other words, what they're doing is if a cell phone user registers on their site, when they are in Walmart, they will get a notification of a one-hour sale that only mobile phone subscribers will be alerted to. This is their way of trying to – but it's interesting. It's two things. It's one, trying to encourage people to register on the site with their cell phone. But also, it's not a mobile strategy at all. It's an in-store strategy. So as opposed to trying to support sales on their website, in a call center, dial-in, or on the web, this is all intended just to get people in the store, which has a certain illogic to it. So
well,
that's what
it's kind of like there is now the blue text special, it seems, right? Instead of the blue, I mean, that's what it's going for. Didn't they also come out with a really inexpensive laptop that they were selling? It's something like sub-$400. Wasn't that Walmart?
I believe so. I'm going to have to double check that, but I
think it was them, and that was a big thing because they're trying. I think that I agree with you. That's an interesting strategy that we're talking about here, and it all relates to bringing people into the store. I guess thinking that Walmart is a one-stop shopping kind of experience, and they really need to get the people in the store, which is a bit opposite of the whole e-concept, right?
Well, the whole merge channel concept is based on that everything other than in-store is more profitable. If you can do an online strategy right, if you can do a mobile strategy right, if you can do your call center, it's a lot cheaper to manage those sales than to manage an in-store sale. So Walmart's approach is a little counterintuitive. They are trying to push people into store when it's actually less expensive for them to keep them buying through the other channels. Their objective is exactly what you said, the impulse buy, which is something that you're going to see 2 years from now online with 3D and some of the Second Life efforts. Right now, that only exists in store. So they believe they want to get them in store, so they'll make a lot of additional add-on purchases. So
that is so weird. You know, you think about, for my audience that doesn't know about Second Life, many of you, I'm sure, are. You have an alternative life, which is a three-dimensional life character in a virtual community. So you're telling me, Evan, and I don't know if you know about this, Kristen, but that what's going to happen is we're going to have this Second Life shopper.
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy.
You have a car?
Oh, boy.
We have already seen a couple of retailers playing with. My favorite was one retailer we were talking to that is doing something about 2 years from now. They are in the home entertainment sales business. And their problem is, it's kind of interesting, they're talking about that the problem right now, if someone goes into one of their stores for a surround sound system, the best they can do is set them up in one of those demo rooms, which is, of course, an unrealistically set up room. That's not like any human being's consumer home,
right.
They've set them up there. The problem is that they want to be able to push that into an online effort. So to do that, what they're going to be doing, what they're thinking of doing, is sending people to the homes. They've already got people going to the homes anyway for installation and consultation. So they send them to the home. They take a digital image of all of their house, all the rooms. They ask questions about the thickness of the carpet, the windows, a wide range of other issues. And then they program it in so there's a digital representation. So now you plug in various surround sound systems and you see in your room with your carpet, in your windows, in your wall, how far it extends out and what will work and what wasn't.
Wow.
And you can actually set the time. So it'll show you where the sun in October at 2 in the afternoon is going to hit, so you'll know where to position things given when you typically would view the stuff there. All kinds of things.
So this is the cool factor. So Kirsten, tell me something. So we have the cool factor, but then what about the people actually spending money? I mean, how do you see it in terms of where the people are going to be spending money and where they're really going to be avoiding this holiday season?
Well, I mean, you know, I was a former retail analyst, and I have a strong place in my heart for the teen retailer, right? I think what you're not going to see people spending money is that middle market, like an Ann Taylor, even though she had better numbers. An Ann Taylor, a J. Jill, a Coldwater Creek, that consumer is dead right now. Mm-hmm. A, there's nothing in the store that appeals to her. Mm-hmm. B, the only thing that she's spending money on right now is kids,
right.
College, and oil.
So at the end of the day, what they'll do is they'll always spend on the kids. That's my theory.
Always.
Yep. My favorite store, by the way, is Chico's. And you know why that is? I think the brilliant strategy of taking a dress that's usually a size 10 and then rebranding it in the Chico's brand and making that a size 2 is brilliant. I mean,
I have to interrupt with you there. I think Chico's is one of the biggest train wrecks in retail right now.
No, I'm not screaming. I just think this one particular thing they did to bring in the adult consumer, the adult female, by
changing sizing. Yeah, that is brilliant. I can be a 10 one day and a 0 the next. I'm in.
Exactly.
I like Chico's because of the Marx Brothers connection, but I don't think that's what they have in mind.
Yeah, I hear you. So we have Abercrombie, Chico's, Hot Topic, and Taylor. So you're saying that top line for the older patron, that's really not going to be the place. So let's talk about some of the younger ones. We have, again, the Hot Topic. We have Abercrombie, right?
Yeah, I mean, Hot Topic is a train wreck, so be very careful there. That is a turnaround story, and I use the term turnaround very loosely. I mean, that was the old goth place in the mall when, you know, kids were disenfranchised, didn't really have access to the internet or cars, and wanted to buy their, you know, their rock T-shirt or a studded belt or Manic Panic hair dye to be, you know, ironic and tragic.
Uh-huh.
Well, unfortunately, the Hot Topic folks never kept up with that gothic consumer.
Right.
Because they're smart and they want fashion too and they want to belong, but, you know, they're just not buying concert T-shirts only, which is kind of where this company just stayed and stagnated, which is very sad because they had great people and great management. So that's unfortunate. Abercrombie, you know, I've had a really tough time with Abercrombie because I feel like they've been riding this whole aspirational consumer thing and this kind of sex prep thing for a long time without innovating their product.
Right.
I really don't see anything new under the sun there. But that's where teens are shopping.
The Hollister brand that they brought out was really not – it was different, don't get me wrong, but it still was the same theme, don't you think?
Well, it's all variations on a theme. And how long can you play that?
Right.
How many hoodies do you need?
Yeah, I hear you. I got my share.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that, you know, I've been watching and paying attention to. Also, a store like Zumiez.
Now that's my favorite. Is that you like that one? That's my favorite. And the recent numbers that came in, I bought them in the mid-30s, and all summer I was talking about it, shot up to in the 50s. The PE was a little hot, but then they come out with okay numbers, and they just take the stock down like crazy.
Yeah, you know, a stock like that, a stock like Crocs, a stock like Lulu, any stock that's had a run like that, the minute there's a little bit of sheepishness that gets crushed.
Mm.
And that's unfortunate.
Well, do you like those for the long haul, that genre?
Well, you know, I have a whole thing right now about technology as the new fashion statement, and that goes back to the point that we were just discussing about cell phones. I mean, it's really your technology now that really defines you as opposed to apparel. And companies that really want to get in on that are developing ways, innovative ways, in fact, to use technology in fabric, in fashion, and are looking at fashion in a whole new way.
Well, I'm going to buy my wife a G-string iPhone, a G-string for the holidays. I think that's
going to be good. I don't know if I want to see that. But, you know, companies like an Under Armour, like a Lululemon, you know, seaweed debacle aside, like a Crocs, you know, they're taking technology and putting it in everyday product.
Right. I hear you. So let's talk about some of the other areas. Let's talk about Starbucks for a minute, because we talked about that you know, before we came on, we were chatting a little bit. Starbucks comes out with lower than anticipated earnings last week and blamed it on a variety of different things. I was in San Francisco recently. This is not new for everybody, but I was in San Francisco recently, and there are Starbucks literally across the street from each other. And it's an amazing thing because while coffee and all that is an amazing phenomenon, and Starbucks brought the cool factor to it with music and internet and all that, and Apple and all. I mean, where are we at saturation point where you just can't have any more coffee houses?
Wow. It's kind of like the gasification of coffee.
Right. Okay.
Now, how many different ways can you skin a cat? At the end of the day, you know, when you have $80 oil and, you know, gas is reaching, you know, close to $4 a gallon, are you still going to stand in line to pay $4 in the morning?
Right.
And, you know, gosh, walking through the streets of Manhattan on my way to work every day, there's a line out of the freaking door.
It's unbelievable.
So, you know, you've tapped into, and that's a question, tapping into this whole, you know, aspirational comfort type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I work on Wall Street and there's the coffee cart right inside outside of my building.
Right.
But there are more people that are coming out of Dean and DeLuca and Starbucks and waiting in line for, you know, the coffee at the cart.
Right. So Evan, what do you think about some of the issues? You know, they recently blamed it on McDonald's. They talked about maybe some of the other places that are taking down some of their market share, Starbucks. Where do you think they're going from here?
Well, they got a couple of issues with Starbucks. First of all, Starbucks is not about coffee. That's simply not what they are doing. It's all about the experience.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry?
I said absolutely.
It's about lifestyle.
Yeah.
And the thing that I am very, very hesitant to say, but it's the only word I can think of, they have been, since their inception, about the coolness factor. The jazz, the environment, the Wi-Fi, all of that is about being a cool, and I can't even say hip at this age, but I'm going to try anyway. They are basically there to provide the experience and being on the cutting edge. It's a place to go. It's a nice place for particularly younger consumers to visit. And that's part of their problem. The problem is that they were masters at social networking long before Facebook and MySpace started to dominate. But they never did anything. To this day, their website is adequate, but anemic. They have viewed the web as a way to do e-commerce. Specifically, they viewed it as a way to sell coffee makers and coffee and a few other knickknacks and maybe some jazz CDs. The fact is, they have not used it to create buzz. They have not used it for community development, which is ironic because they mastered the whole idea of social networking before most other sites did. So their sites have not done anything. So what's happening today is they have lost the buzz. Others have taken on a lot of that coolness factor. Other people are moving in that direction. And Facebook and MySpace and others are generating let's meet here and there. They're not talking about let's meet at Starbucks. So they have lost some of their edge. And now they're thinking, gee, maybe e-commerce withdrawn. Maybe websites are more than just selling stuff. Maybe it's to help our brick and mortar. But at this point, it's too late. So they have lost their edge. And the web is a big part of their presence. No web strategy, no mobile strategy, except downloading music in their store, which misses the point. So they've been behind that curve, and I think that's part of the issue. And since it never was about the coffee, their coffee, so help me, is not that good. And it's
I can't stand. Personally, I'll drink it if I have to. I find it very bitter, and it's not even what I would consider the coffee that you get, you know, all over Europe. Whenever I come back from Europe, I swear off American coffee, you know, anything that
Absolutely.
We get from here. And then I slowly but surely creep back to it, you know, get the milk, put the sugar in, you know. There I'm drinking black coffee or espresso or something like that all the time. Here I come back and I say, you know, never again.
But speaking of American coffee, you've made the point. Consumer Reports did a piece a little while ago where they did comparison testing in a pure culinary sense and established that the best coffee was not at Starbucks, although beating them was Dunkin' Donuts. The best was McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there
Yummy.
Are a lot of things yeah, you can say that. About you can say about McDonald's. Coolness factor they don't have. You're not going to sit there with a bunch of guys, oh, let's hook up at McDonald's unless you're 9.
Or 80.
Yeah, right.
Well, yes, or 80. But the fact is that it's not about the coffee. It's about the environment. And they let the web drop. And now that their store sales are dropping, they don't have any place to go. So Starbucks is an interesting case, but they missed a golden opportunity.
It's interesting because, again, I have this whole concern over the consumer right now. And I think that the consumer is very, very nervous because of a lot of the other things that are involved in the economy and much to do with the concern over people not telling them the truth and really going out and doing things that were underhandedly for their own benefit and then dumping it on the consumer once again. And that's the kind of problem that we have right now. You know, the markets hate uncertainty. We always know that. They should have come out in the beginning, told us what was going on a little bit clearer and been a little bit more, you know, fun about it. And I think we wouldn't have this backlash. You know, Kristen, Aaron Task and I were talking. We've talked a few times about this whole, you know, the eye of the storm and the markets and comparing it to a hurricane. And back in, I think it was August, he and I were both discussing that there's another, not one, but many shoes to drop here in the future, because we don't think a lot of the information is known and has been released. And I just talked to him again last week about this, and he said, you know, we got kind of sucker punched. And he even said that on his podcast, mm-hmm. that, you know, he feels that, you know, we were drawn back in, and so were investors and consumers drawn back in on false hopes that, you know, things are no problem. There's plenty of liquidity, but that's not really the case, is it?
No, I mean, and you know, I hate to sound completely bearish here because usually I'm inherently bullish, but I think we're in a recession. I think it's only going to get worse, and no one's saying that. No one's talking about it.
Right.
The consumer is scared.
Yeah.
They're nervous, and they also feel lied to. And, you know, I really don't see this sense of joy and consumerism that's going to happen over the holidays. I think you're going to see one big gift, and it will probably be a technology-related gift. It's going to be the Wii for the entire family.
Good.
Look up, Johnny. Here you go.
Oh, that's
we're
good.
All playing it.
I want mine.
One gift.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, it's going to be an iPod.
Yep.
It's going to be an Apple phone.
Yep, I hear you. Let me just do this for a second. Let me just interrupt you. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to finish up this, but talk about what we really, I think, is kind of one of the most fascinating things that is happening right now in retail. It's not going to be about the holidays, but it's going to be more about a breakup and a movement to a change in how they do business between Borders and Amazon. So stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, gang. This is Andrew Horowitz. And what better gift can you give anyone this holiday season than the gift of financial success, financial security, financial peace of mind? I've written the book, The Disciplined Investor, to really give you that, give you the sense of I can do it, I can understand what's going on, and I'm not just going to hand off my money and just let it just either rot or flourish. I'm going to know what's happening. Each chapter outlines some of the most important issues and components and disciplines of financial success and financial security, like the chapter on technical analysis that discusses exactly what are charts and what are double tops and double bottoms and all the other important components of technical and charting analysis. The chapter on risk management helps you to save yourself from some real grief in the downstrokes of the market. And the chapter on fundamental analysis goes over ratios and peg ratios and all the components of balance sheets, cash flows, and really gives you an understanding of what's going on in the stock market. Give yourself and a good friend of yours, someone you love, the gift of financial peace of mind this year. Pick up your copy of The Disciplined Investor at many fine bookstores at Borders.com, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and TheDisciplinedInvestor.com. Also, the audiobook is available on our site. Each of the chapters are outlined and narrated by me, available right now for $24.95. Pick it up and do yourself a favor. Have a great holiday. All right, we're back here talking all about retail because it's time for the holidays on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and we're here with Kristen Bentz, who is the managing editor of Real Money at TheStreet.com, and Evan Schumann, who is the in the retail area as well, and he is an editor for eWeek, Ziff Davis publication, as well as the fact that he has what's the name of your blog, Evan?
StorefrontBackTalk.com.
StorefrontBackTalk.com. And he has some great things if you check it out, because what on there is just a tremendous amount of information, I guess, daily or more about everything retail. But let's talk about this whole area of lying, because one of my pet peeves is this whole area of rebates. And I question how many people really get their rebates at the end of the day, because there's no good way to track it. You know, you have a $59.95 product, they advertise really for $29.95, small print after rebate, and you have to jump through so many hoops. And who knows if you ever get your rebates? I mean, how does that really impact retailers and consumers?
Well, clearly, retailers operate on the assumption that a healthy percentage of people are not going to bother with those forms and materials. It's a manufacturers or retailers, depending on the nature of the rebate. So that's been in existence for some time, and consumers would do well to try and take advantage of the rebate opportunities, because otherwise they're just subsidizing what they don't have to subsidize.
But don't they inherently, doesn't that whole rebating process that we know that takes 4 to 6 weeks to get your money back, not the instant rebates, but 4 to 6 weeks to get your money back, and you have to jump through all these hoops, doesn't that really lend itself to some underhanded policy by the retailers? Or potential
It is an underhanded policy on the retailers. That's the whole point.
No. Okay. So great. Another thumbs up for retailers.
We know a more effective way to use that, if I can interrupt, is,
yes,
you know, what we call in marketing a bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
American Eagle did a great promotion right around back to school, where you, and it was kind of a quasi, Evan, to your point about involving a community and Facebook type application. They had different fits of jeans, because if you know teen girls, finding jeans that fit various body types is very difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
So American Eagle had all these separate fits for back to school. You could come in, buy a pair of jeans, and at the cash wrap, when you bought that pair of jeans, you were automatically entered into a contest, okay, to find your favorite fit. So if your favorite fit of jean won this contest, you could come back, and then you would get cash money, or you would get some sort of rebate. That's a bounce back. That's effective, and it's not sneaky and underhanded.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great same-store sales saver for American Eagle, and they actually did much better than one would think for back-to-school comp. So that's, you know, kind of an example of where it can be positive. But all of these rebates or in-store rebates, completely nefarious.
And the problem is that they're doing their estimates and their projections based on these, and who knows if they want to change their, return ratio in terms of who actually gets the rebate or not to kind of move EPS up. You kind of have to scratch your head and wonder about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, great.
Well, one of the
go ahead, Evan.
Never mind.
Oh, go ahead. Go right ahead.
I was just going to say that one of the issues right now is the whole CRM approach, which is customer loyalty, establishing what people are doing, and they are doing a lot of rebates and couponing with mobile phones. And the advantage of that is, from the consumer standpoint, it's a lot easier to cash them in and to secure that money, but also it's a lot easier for the retailer to track and see where it's going.
Right.
And that provides the backing for a lot of deals between the retailers and the manufacturers, that every time I push one of these out and sell one of these, there's all these incentives back, and I can sell it to more people than anyone else, and I can tell you exactly which demographic is doing it. So right now, mobile transactions are very big with couponing, and that's going to probably change a lot of the dynamics of the rebates and couponing over the next couple of years.
Hmm. Well, it's really kind of amazing, because for the longest time, I really had no desire to be anything near retail as an advisor or an investor. And recently we picked up a few, but for the most part, just a few, one or two positions. And I think that the retail, you know, consistently has a bad name, and you just have to be very careful, because it's a fickle consumer that, and there's so many things that rely on the consumer and their attitudes and their tastes and likes, dislikes, the economy. And there's just so many things that could go wrong with retail. But let's get into this discussion about Borders and Amazon. Now, you know, my book just came out this week, The Disciplined Investor. Hopefully everybody's getting a copy for their friends and their relatives. It's available at Borders, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble, everywhere good, my site on our website. So here's the thing. In the process, I think that recent discovery that, or not too recent, but, you know, we start to realize that Amazon and Borders, if you ever go to their websites, they're identical. And it says that Amazon is running, or Amazon is doing the distribution, the marketing for Borders. So for many years, from the beginning and inception date, I believe, of the Borders online strategy, there was the reliance on Amazon to handle everything. Well, now all of a sudden, or at least in the works, has been this process that they're going to break away. And Evan, you wrote a great story some time ago, and I think you have some valuable insight in this. I'm really curious, what does this mean to Amazon and Borders?
Well, the original rationale for the merger was that Borders, again, it's not dissimilar from the very in-store-centric mentality that we talked about in Starbucks. Borders saw their presence, obviously, in stores. They knew they had to have a web presence, but they didn't really want to do what they figured would be involved to do it right. Amazon is obviously in the book-selling business, so they cut a deal. We'll turn all of our revenue over to you. We'll do a split, but you take care of the web presence, and we won't deal with it at all. And that worked fine for a few years. Everything was fairly copacetic, until all of a sudden Borders needed to have a much more intelligent, integrated web presence within their stores. Part of it is that their stores weren't doing that well. They needed to boost it, and Amazon would not go into the store. And of all the great strategic reasons, the reason they wouldn't really came down, strangely enough, to sales tax. That if indeed they started to go into those stores, they would have a physical presence and their tax structure would have to change in a lot of states. And they didn't want to be bothered with that. So Borders said, if we want to do these things, we're going to have to do them on our own, at which point, hello, divorce court.
But what is this going to mean to the bottom line of – I mean, this is going to cost Borders a lot of money to break away in terms of just developing their website into a very full functional – because, I mean, Amazon has a very, very robust website. You know, what is this going to mean? There's a lot of competition. There's BarnesandNoble.com and a lot of smaller names out there. But, I mean, how much is this going to cost Borders on the bottom line, and does it really hurt Amazon?
Well, let's take a look at – first of all, it's not going to hurt Amazon because Amazon is diversifying so much they're not even – you can't even call them a book site anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of Borders, they're going to be doing some stuff on their website. There's no doubt about that. But this – again, this is not a web strategy. This is an in-store strategy. You're going to be seeing much more innovation within their stores. For example, this was – and we talked about this in the story you referenced, but this is their ideal. And I think it's going to take them quite some time to get there, if they ever will. But the idea is that it's not about books. The same way Starbucks isn't about coffee, Borders isn't about books. It's about the experience. So, for example, someone is doing – they want to do a vacation to Hawaii. So they go to Borders and they want to check this out. So typically today, you go into Borders, you go into the travel section, and you flip through a few books on Hawaii. And if you're like me, you take notes and you don't buy the book. But let's say you're honest and you go in there. What they want the experience to be is it's very different. You go into the section and you're interested in travel to Hawaii. So you go to the travel section and you get into the Hawaiian section. So they'll have lots of books on Hawaii, but they will also have terminals, kiosks throughout. So you can enter in information and it will tell you all kinds of things about it. So the idea would be they would have little pineapple selections and all of that to create the ambiance. And when you go to check out, they don't just hand you a bag with the books that you've chosen, but they also hand you a bag with tickets to Hawaii, because they've set it up through partnerships with travel, with a printed out hotel verification from that, a golfing certificate because you did that as well. And again, they will drop in a little bag of macadamia nuts. They would actually – it's not about the book. It's about you want to go to Hawaii, you go there. You want to go something about technology. You look at the technology books. You're going to get a CD with various applications that relate to that. You are interested in a social environment. You're going into the searching for love section. They are going to have little coffees and setups there with singles. And it'll be every Tuesday night from X to – from 8 to 9 o'clock, whatever it is you're going to the bookstore for, their argument is it's really not about a book. It's about getting information, being entertained, whatever it is. And whatever that is, they're going to build around it everything else so that their revenue will become less and less from books per se and more from these various ancillary services.
Yeah, but may I interrupt you, Evan? You know, at the end of the day, though, when it comes to books, I mean, that's where they make their money or whatever the products they're selling. They're not charging for the social process. And the problem is that I will tell you that if the book is $19.95 in the store and it is $16.95 on the online, it's the same thing. Why do people travel 3 miles to save a penny on gas? I mean, it's ridiculous. But they see this as an opportunity to save money, and they will do it. They will go to the far reaches of the earth, people, to save some money. So then the question is, did they just enhance their overall expense load and bring down the net by doing all these wonderful things in this process? And if, in fact, they are trying to do this in-store process, why do they have to break away from Amazon to begin with?
Because Amazon will not provide them kiosks and web content in-store because of the tax issue.
Right.
So if they're going to provide any kind of online interface in store, they've got to do it themselves. So if they've got to create that anyway, they might as well take the entire thing back. But this is about generating additional revenue from other items. But most importantly, it's about making their in-store a destination.
All right, so what you're saying is that I'm going to go into Looking for Love and potentially Dr. Ruth is going to be there handing me a book. I mean, that's what we're talking about.
That's certainly one scenario, if that's your ideal, yes.
All right. What do you think about Amazon, Borders, Barnes & Noble, the book business, Kristen?
I don't think it's going to hurt Amazon one bit, you know. And honestly, you know, I think a few years ago when this was such an issue and Borders needed that distribution channel, that was something they needed Amazon for. But quite frankly, prices have come down when networking that type of distribution online for oneself. And I think that, you know, if they want to take that in-house, more power to them. To your point, Evan, we do have one right next door to my office, and it's absolutely you know, set up the way that you're describing, and, you know, they're frequent guests and that are touting the latest book, and it's, you know, very much like the hip happening place to be. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, one can also argue, you know, aren't books a commodity or are they a luxury? So I think it depends on the type of consumer that you're going after and their share of wallet that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anyone can look at Amazon online for that book they want if they're looking to compete on price. But if they want to get out of the house and they want to socialize and they want to find a place or a community, you know, they're going to be willing to pay that extra money to show up and get those vignettes and get
right.
those special coffees and, mm-hmm. and hang out with those people and be a part of something else. The same reason why people go to a Starbucks, to kind of bring everything back full circle.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we really paying for? We're paying to be in the club.
Yeah, we're paying for entertainment. We're paying for our entertainment.
Absolutely.
We're paying for the experience. And the fact of the matter is that we're trying to wrap it up into one big, nice and neat package. I guess people used to do that a bit at the libraries, which are clearly not the hip place. Although I will tell you that the library by me has 50 or 60 computers, and that place is packed with kids every
mm-hmm.
single day playing all sorts of games and theoretically doing research, you know, and just, you know, hanging out there and doing what they do, you know, copying from Wikipedia to paste into a term paper. So is there any concern over and any fighting and any maybe potential lawsuits about trade secrets or any kind of breaking of contracts or, you know, issue about consumer, what they can say, what they, is there anything going on there between the two?
I would say no. It's a fairly, from what where people were talking to on both sides, a friendly dissolving of the relationship. Again, Borders wants to go in a different direction that Amazon has no interest in going into. And Amazon is still selling books, but they've never seen Borders as a rival. They don't expect to see them now as a rival. I don't think there's going to be any problem at all about it. The only question will be if Borders' project falls apart, they may want to get back into bed with Amazon, and Amazon may say, not
yeah.
so fast.
I hear you. And yeah, Jeff Bezos may be laughing all the way again to the bank on that one if that happens. So nothing sensational there. I will tell you something interesting that people don't know. The book business I'm talking about now for a moment is actually an interesting business because they're really the risk to these. First of all, it's so deep of between distributors and the publishers and all the people involved. It's quite amazing. But most of the risk is on the publishers because most of the books are taken on consignment through Amazon and mm-hmm. and they can order it. They don't even have to stock a lot of it because the second tier distributors, even though they have fulfillment centers, but they'll order just minimums to get by. It's kind of an interesting business. And I think that if you really think about the business and understand. And you know the real components. It's probably the reason why Amazon has done so well. Borders recently came up on one of my screens as one of the I guess the low man that may be really jumping out moving forward from a screening standpoint. But I don't know. I still have my reservations from a stock standpoint. That is so. Let's end up with this point. What about the international dollar? You know, or I should say international money, not the international dollar. You know, keep hearing about the international is going to hold up, and they're holding up New York real estate. You know, Kristen, you're in New York. How's the real estate in New York?
It's all about tourists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's interesting walking down the streets of Wall Street, which used to be a ghost town. We now have Hermes, we have Thomas Pink, and we have, you know, our newest neighbor is Tiffany. And let me tell you, the stores are packed, and
mm-hmm.
it's all, you know, foreign or European shoppers.
Right.
And that's great. We need that because, let me tell you, American shoppers are not out there buying luxury goods at that level.
Right.
So we need them.
But what happens when the dollar moves up? Doesn't that dry up immediately?
I don't think so. I think that that's going to be a residual process. I don't think it's that rapid.
All right. Well, I would hope that's the case because it seems that that's the last hope that we're hanging on to, because everybody seems to think the consumer's out and the domestic consumer is kind of out right now.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see. Evan, any last words on maybe where people should be looking? And of course, you know, all of this directs back to the markets, because that's what this is all about, trying to help people make better investments. And let me summarize this one point. It seems to me that generally speaking, we need to be very careful, very cautious about the retail area. There's a few components, a few areas that seem very strong, but for the most part, this is not something that we want to put all of our money into at this point by any means. It's not something we're really excited about. But other than that, it doesn't also seem like there's anything different that's going on right now than in the past, huh? Would we agree with that?
I have to tell you that I don't think retail is dead. I think that there are clear winners and losers, just like any other sector, and it's all about execution. So put your money on those retailers that are executing well and have less exposure to the U.S. consumer.
Right.
Yeah, what you have to understand about retail in a financial sense is that it's all about extra. And what I mean by that is that the base of retail is most likely never going to go away. The groceries, the gas, the things that people are going to need are going to stay there, and they're going to be relatively stable with mild fluctuations. But the real issue is when the American consumer feels confident about what is going on, retail gets the vast majority of that benefit. And when they feel skittish, it gets hurt the most. Right now, people are feeling a bit skittish. So retail, as a good barometer of America's happy feelings, is going to be a more conservative place. Then again, that's going to drop pricing, and maybe it's a good investment because it's going to likely get better starting around the summer.
Yeah, okay.
Yep, it will. So you want to get in there and pick your winners that are a little bit beaten down and hold on to them until the consumer bounces back.
I hear you. Yep, and I hear you. And I think that 12 to 24, where they're always being bought something by parents or for gifts, is a great place to be right now. We're going to continue doing that. So thanks so much for being here. Chris, let me start with you. What's the best place to get in touch with you?
Best place to get in touch with me is thestreet.com.
Okay.
And that's kristen.bentz@thestreet.com. I have a blog as well. You can reach me at thetalentedblonde or talentedblonde.com.
All right, great. And Evan, you?
The best place is to visit us here at storefrontbacktalk.com. That's storefrontbacktalk.com. I guess I didn't really add much by saying it a second time.
But it's just like you have to do it. It sounded very professional. I like that.
I'm blonde. It takes longer.
there we go. And or eschuman, eschuman, at storefrontbacktalk.com. So I worked it in a third time.
All right, great. And what we'll do is I'll make sure to put that on the notes for the show, and hopefully we can touch base when the consumer is a little more confident. We see some things happening in a great way. Thanks for joining me today, and have a great holiday.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Take care.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.